Colonel Neil Reel 2.
Cohima was about, I suppose, a quarter of the way in power, as far as I can remember. And it must have been 9,000 odd feet high. And the scenery there was absolutely incredible. And I have such a clear picture of it in my mind still to this day. At Cohima, I had rather an unfortunate happening in my small group of gaffers. When I received my orders for the following day from the company sergeant major, I called my senior gaffer rank, a Jemadar, whose name I have forgotten, to give him orders for tomorrow's march. I found he was, God knows where he got the rum from, but he found some rum and he was incredibly drunk, absolutely stupefied. So I sent him away with a key between his ears, and the following morning I told my con commander, Scotty, what had happened, and with his permission I brought him in front of Scotty on a charge of being drunk on active service. And much to my delight, he was transferred into space to the Brigade Headquarters Defence Platoon. This meant, of course, I had no dirt officer once he'd gone, and my senior rank was rather indifferent, overweight, overpromoted, Havilah, called Purkadoj Limu, about whom I'll tell some things in due course of my story. So he was my number one, so to speak, and it was through him that I had to pass all my future orders. And I felt very sorry for my men. They'd got a totally inexperienced young British officer, unknown to them before, from another regiment in command of them, and this very indifferent Havilah to act as number two. They should have gotten, they certainly deserved better. So when I sorted out the future of my senior gaffer officer, we moved on with the column. Here I should add perhaps that Scotty required Sergeant Aldy and me to ride our charges up and down the column the whole time we were marching up the Manipur Road. And the reason for this was the mules were still playing up rather, and they bucked and kicked and threw their loads. And it was essential that Ormond and I should be present to help the muleteers sort things out when the mules ditched their loads. And whilst the men's feet were getting tired and sore marching on the semi-tarmac road, Ormond's and my bottoms were getting even tireder and sorer trotting up and down this hard road. The next thing that sticks out in my mind about our approach march to Imphal was we came across quite a number of Naga work parties working on the side of the road to repair landslide damage. They're an incredible collection of chaps. They were real, how can I describe them? They were savages, I suppose, the only way I can describe them, and they were very hairy sort of people. But they got a tremendous reputation for themselves during the fighting in Kohima and Imphal areas, helping the British and Indian soldiers, guiding them and carrying wounded. They were a marvellous sort of people, and despite their wild looks, they certainly were worth their weight in gold. But at that stage of the war, of course, they hadn't had to prove themselves. Well, our march continued, and the next place of note I can recall passing was Kangatombe. And I remember hearing that Kangatombe was the scene of pretty heavy fighting during the 1944 battles. And when we passed it, it was a most attractive looking little place, as Kohima was, and I've always remembered it. We got to the Imphal plain, I suppose, around about the 20th of January, and we went through Imphal town, which was like any other Indian small station, and we camped down on the plain to the east of the road for about 10 days, I suppose. No training was carried out. It was just make and mend, I suppose, mostly. And at the end of our stay in Imphal Plain, we had a visit, an inspection from the then CNC India, General Wavell. And Wavell came along to inspect the brigade, who were falling in column groups. And accompanying him was the famous Vinnie Joe Sewell. And he was there with his Boy Scout Kiwi-type felt hat, the camera round his neck, and when Wavell was going down the front ranks of the column in their approved style, inspecting the troops, Vinegar Joe was either on his knee or on his hunkers, taking photographs of the men from all angles. It really was the most extraordinary sight. What Wavell must have made all this, goodness knows, but we were fascinated by the antics of Vinegar Joe. Anyway, when Wavell had finished his inspection, he stood up on a small, high ground, mound type of place, so that he could be seen, and he gave us a pep talk and a farewell speech. And when he finished telling us what was what, he said, "Gentlemen, God bless you. If only the great man had had a crystal ball, I'm quite sure he'd said, 'God help you.' Because that's the sort of help we really needed once we got deep inside Burma. And and I suppose it must have been round about the 30th of January, eventually, when we, the whole brigade, left Imphal, headed for Tamil and the Chindran. When we left Imphal, we found the road was much narrower than it had been until then, so Normandy and I were relieved of our horse-riding manoeuvres, and we were able to march with the soldiers. We marched, I remember, first through Pallel, and then over the soon-to-be infamous Chenam Pass. And after we left Chenam, we must have been marching below the features that were talked about by so many of my contemporaries in the Gurkha Brigade. Scraggy, Gibraltar, Crete, Nippon Hill. And at the time we were marching on them, of course they were nameless hills, but when I heard subsequently of the fighting that was taking place on particularly Scraggy, I sort of a picture in my mind's eye where my chums were fighting. And I always remember that particular part of our march to Burma, going beneath these features that were to take the brunt of the Japanese offensive the following year. So after we passed beneath Scraggy and Gibraltar, etc., we must have been pretty near the border with Burma. As I remember one night, we were told that the following day would take us to a spot pretty close to the border. Thereafter, we would march by night once we crossed the border. I'm not sure why, but this is what we were told. And the night march, which we eventually conducted, was some 33 miles in length. And it was a very dusty road. And I can recall stumbling along with the dust kicked up for the men's feet and the mules' feet, the dust up our noses, dust in our mouths. And it was really perhaps an unnecessary manoeuvre to have conducted this particular phase of our march in by night. I'd have thought it had been easier to conduct it by day. Anyway, this night march was duly completed. And though I did not know where we were precisely at the time, I think we must have been within close distance of Tamil. When we left our halting place the following day after our night march. We were told, or it was common rumour in the column, that the gully down which we were marching at this particular point had been the route out of Burma by the civilian refugees, and that many had died in this particular area. And it was a grim looking place, certainly there was still no sign of the refugees' skeletons. I suppose they must have been collected and buried in due course. But it was a rather miserable part of our march, thinking about the suffering the refugees must have undergone there in 41, or 42 rather. Well, eventually we reached the Chinrin, and we reached it just north of the village of Tonhei. And there was a wide sandy beach on our side of the river, and the river itself must have been 250 yards wide, according to my maps. And we reached this point in the river on the 14th of February, 43, St. Valentine's Day. And just before we started to cross, at about 10:00 hours in the morning, Bill Williams, the Colonel Second in Command, came to me and mentioned that they'd just received a signal from Wingate about some administrative matter, giving quotations from the Old Testament, chapter and verse, where they were sent to the Colonel Commander, and he had to fish out his Bible from his pack and interpret what Wingate really meant. And I suppose Wingate's idea was that by using the Old Testament, he would fox the Japanese intelligence rather more than he would if he'd used a conventional code. It's the only reason I can think he habitually used the Old Testament for sending his messages. And I often was glad that, I was not a common commander and had to carry an extra weight in the shape of a large Bible. Later, when our Burma riflemen were collecting the boats from the village of Tonhei, we had another signal from Wingate. And this, I think, was in code. And what he said, so I was told, was that once we had crossed the Chinrin and were in enemy territory, any man who was wounded and was unable to move would be left in a friendly village to his fate. And I thought, on the eve of battle, to give an order like that was guaranteed to cause men's morale to dip extremely. I know the British soldiers were not best pleased at hearing what their fate might be. And for my part, I never even passed the message on to my Gurkhas. In those days, none of them spoke English. And I thought if I didn't tell them, at least they wouldn't know what might happen to them under adverse circumstances. In the Indian Army, we'd always made such a thing of looking after wounded and saving them whenever possible. And this edict from Wingate went down extremely badly. Having received that boost to our morale, we started crossing the river. And the boats were country boats. They took, as far as I can remember, up to about 20 men. And what we decided to do was this, or what Scotty decided to do was this. We crossed the river, taking mules, tethered four or five at a time to the stern of the boats, and sway them through across on their own volition. This worked surprisingly very, very well indeed, and we got all our mules over with no problem at all. Other columns, I gather, did get some trouble, but we were very fortunate, and I suppose by about 1700 hours or so, we must have been completely across the river. I remember that first night, based on the enemy side of the river, lying awake at night and feeling extremely excited to think we were at last in enemy territory and that Operation Longcast was about to begin. That night was uneventful, and so was the following day. So were many days to come, in fact. We left the river early one morning after feeding, and our first village that I remember passing through was a little village some 7 miles from the river called Mierne. It was a beautiful little village. Fascinating to see for the first time Burmese houses standing up on their stilts. It took my fancy greatly, and I always remember my mind's eye and what the village looked like. I believe somewhere in the area of Mierne, the brigade took its first airdrop, but my column was not involved. We didn't require rations at that time, as far as I can recall. And we moved on from Mierne northeast towards Metcalette. Metcalette was another small village on a river called the Nam Karun Chong. From Metcalette, we continued marching northeast to Omnikane on the Nam Saga Chong. This is a big village some 40 miles from the Chimbun, and here we in Akon received our first airdrop. We were based in a bamboo thicket or forest for some 2 days, and a platoon from the King's were sent some 2 miles south to the village of Sitsok to act as some form of protection to the main body while we were collecting our parachutes from the airdrop, DZ. They found that the Japs had passed through Sitsok very recently, but they did not encounter them. And this message was duly relayed to the common commander, Major Scott. The DZ was to be on a pay area some 800 by 2,000 yards long, and it was covered, protected by another of the rifle platoons. Scotty asked me to do a reconnaissance and see where I could locate the mules where they could wait safely whilst the drop was taking place. We had some bullocks and bullock carts allotted to our column, I think perhaps in Fowl, and these had been traipsing along with our column, being more of a nuisance than help. And sensibly, Scotty decided to slaughter the bullocks. Bullocks were waiting for the airdrop. And the BORs, at least, could have the benefit of fresh meat. Being Hindus, of course, my soldiers wouldn't eat bullock flesh. So they missed out on an extra meal. Now, this is the first parachute drop most of us had ever seen. Now, when the aircraft eventually came in, I, for one, was absolutely absorbed by the whole procedure. The aircraft were DC-3 Dakotas, and whilst the parachutes were being dropped, they were flying over the DZ fairly high. I'm not certain what height it would be. But when they dropped the sacks of rice and mule fodder, these were free dropped, and for which the planes came in much, much lower, perhaps no more than a few hundred feet above the DZ. And we could see quite clearly the RAF crew at the doors chucking out these two maun sacks of rice or mule fodder. Two mauns are about 164 pounds odd in weight. And these came tumbling out of the aircraft, turning over slowly and slowly and slowly, but coming down nonetheless at tremendous speed, hitting the ground with a whack. And if any soldier or mule had been underneath, they would have been undoubtedly killed. Hence the reason for Scotty saying to me that I should choose an area where the mules could wait with safety. Anyway, to cut a long description short, The drop was duly completed, and as far as I can remember, I think only food was dropped on this occasion. My muleteers and I loaded up the parachute packs and the sacks, and the mules took the food back to our bivouac area where it was distributed. The rations we had been dropped were shakapura biscuits, which were square dog biscuit type biscuits, rice, small tins of cheese, raisins, tinned meat and vegetable, the meat was lamb, powdered milk, tea bags and sugar. From this, the BRs made something they called biscuit knob, which was a favourite of theirs. They crumble up the shakapura biscuits, sprinkle sugar and raisins over, and either hot or cold powdered milk was then poured into the mess tin, and the whole was stirred up and squashed and flattened and made into a sort of porridge. And really, it was very nice indeed, but sadly, my Gurkhas didn't like it very much. They preferred their biscuits straight and their raisins straight. When we later got clothing got to us, it might be sensible to mention now what our dress was in those days. We were all wearing felt hats with camouflage nets. The BORs had single thickness felt hats, and the Gurkhas and Burmese troops had the double thickness hats. Khaki shirts and trousers, web anklets, and black iron studded boots known as boots ankle. The equipment we wore were 37 pattern belts, braces, small haversack, water bottle, an 08 big pack. 142 company soldiers carried burdens. We carried in our packs two pairs of socks, pullover, mess tin, chlorinating tablets, anti-mosquito ointment, canvas rubber-soled hockey boots, cap comforters, knife and spoon, towel, soap, toothbrush, paste, spare laces, water wings, and toggle ropes. In our basic pouts, men had 1 4-second fused 36 grenade, 50 rounds of 303 ammunition for our rifles, 5 20-round magazines for Tommy guns, and the weapons carried by the men were as follows. In the rifle regiment commando platoons, there were Thompson submachine guns, number 1 Mark III Lee Enfield rifles with long sword bayonets, plus section brand LMGs. Support weapons were carried by the support platoon, in addition to personal weapons, 2 Vickers medium machine guns and 2 3-inch mortars. The Gurkha muleteers' weapons were 1 LMG for the whole group, and individual Lee Enfields, sword bayonets, plus cookeries. I carried a 38 Smith & Wesson pistol plus a Lee Enfield rifle. After we'd taken our first drop, which, as I say, was mainly of rations and hardly any clothing or equipment, we moved about 30 miles in a number of days, almost due east, to a mountain range known as the Zinbin Tong Dan on our maps, but we always called it the escarpment. This was some 1,800 feet in high, and it ran more or less due north-south. Over this mountain range, there was a narrow footpath which we were taking, and it was mixed scrub and primary jungle on either side of the track. The trees were growing close to the edge of the track, and it proved to be a hellish impediment for our mules. The wretched loads snagged, and the trees tugged the saddles. The loads were twisted and turned on the animals' backs, and the result was, after a very short while, they started to get their first set of galls on their willows mainly, some on their flanks and their stomachs. And eventually, these poor beasts, when they were badly galled on their withers, we could literally see straight through their withers from side to side. The galls were so deep and gangrenous. I had one Indian Army Veterinary Corps, Nike, Ram Fowler by name, who looked after my mules extremely well. He was a very kind soul, and he doted on his charges. And he helped them as best he could to get over the the terrible problems they had with their galls. Sometimes we found that when the animals were too badly galled, we had to take their loads off and overload the fitter animals, who later, of course, suffered in their turn, and then the loads had to go back to be carried by the original mules who don't first succumb to galls. These poor beasts, they marched and marched and marched for us and followed the drum all the way, and the stench of their galls was dreadful as we were marching beside them. It was just like marching beside a rotting corpse. They carried our bedding, our food, heavy weapons and ammunition as far as we could go. And if there were any heroes in the Wingate expedition, they were our mules. They really were marvellous beasts. I don't think anyone who had contact with them could ever forget them, nor being grateful to them. Once we crossed the escarpment where all the mules' trouble really started, the 8th column turned southeast towards the Irrawaddy. And we passed through, I remember, the villages of Waymacan, Chongli, Pinbon, and Van Mork. I, at this time, had no maps, no compass. And as I mentioned earlier, I never attended any of Swati's own groups. So most of my information as far as where we were headed, in what direction, where we were, which village we were passing, was picked up by asking the Raika platoon commanders what was what.
Were there villages in the villages, or had they abandoned them?
Oh, most of the villages were full. I don't think I ever saw an abandoned village anywhere. No, I'm certain of that. And after we left the area of Van Mork, we crossed first the railway line, that was the Michener-Rangoon railway line. And I remember as the country was very open along either side of the line, we crossed an extended line in a rush, so that we wouldn't present a visible target for too long to prying eyes. And my memory tells me that the next feature of note that we crossed was the Mesa River. Whether we crossed the Mesa before the railway line or after, I can't really be certain, but looking at my current maps that I have, I think it undoubtedly must have been the railway line before the river. Anyway, having crossed over the Mesa, we came to an area of very dry country. We were in a wide chong bed, sandy, and dotted about were clumps of thick lantana. There were also five small pagodas. When we were in this area, I can remember so clearly, a chap I had not even met from the 3rd Battalion, Jock Stuart Jones, who had come to us from the Royal Scots, having been commissioned from the ranks into the 1st Foot. He had been posted to the 3rd Battalion in Jhansi, and he had gone in with the 4th Column. He joined us here in this area.